everyone assumes because they got product market fit in crypto for the first time, but it actually, it wasn't like Arthur didn't invent perpetual. So perpetual futures are actually, that was actually proposed by none other than Robert Shiller back in 1992. And I just find that such a fun, like path dependence sort of fact of history. It never really took off in TradFi, but just found product market fit with our specific type of degens. Hey everyone, this episode is brought to you by Say, the blazing fast parallelized blockchain, which is unlocking Solana-like performance for the vast ocean of ETH devs out there. Now, you're going to be hearing all about Say and their new V2 upgrade, but if you take away one thing, the EVM is here to stay. There are some problems with it, which we're going to get into later in the episode, but Say, and especially their V2 upgrade, is helping solve that. So thank you very much, Say, for making this episode possible. Hey guys, big shout out to Uniswap. Uniswap is delivering the best on-chain trading experience, period, bar none. They've got a bunch of cool new features coming out, like Uniswap X, limit orders, real-time data insights. We're going to be hearing all about those features later in the program. But for now, Uniswap, thanks for making this episode possible. We'll get right back to it.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Bell Curve. Before we jump in, quick disclaimer. The views expressed by my co-host today are their personal views, and they do not represent the views of any organization with which the co-hosts are associated with. Nothing in the episode is construed or relied upon as financial, technical, tax, legal, or other advice. You know the deal. Now, let's jump into the episode.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Bell Curve. Today, I'm joined by Nick Trelesky, who's a crypto options trader at Cumberland DRW. Nick, welcome to the show, man.
Hey, Mike. Nice to meet you. Nice to be here on Blockworks. It's going to be fun.
Yeah, man. This is going to be a great one. I think what I'd love to do is, you know, you have a really interesting seat in this industry at an options market making desk. And I think there are a lot of folks that understand, would say that they understand what's going on in derivatives, options, et cetera, but don't have a very clear picture. And you have a very boots on the ground understanding of what's going on. So can we just start at a 10,000 foot level and just describe, like, what does the sort of options and derivative space look like in crypto today?
Yeah, sure. So options and derivatives in crypto started quite a while ago, actually, surprisingly. It was like 2017 when Deribit and these offshore exchanges started to kind of pick up steam and people started trading small size on them. But I would say the explosion of crypto options really happened in 2021 as more and more sophisticated players kind of came in and started to market make and then also, you know, start trading strategies to generate yield and to also, you know, take various kinds of directional risk using options. But the space in general has been kind of a quiet grower underneath the explosion of the crypto, like derivatives markets. Like, I mean, obviously everyone knows perps. They're just a great product that is very simple to understand. That's just linear risk on instruments with a funding rate. So for a lot of retail and a lot of institutional participants, perps have been a very good product for either hedging their portfolios or just expressing risk in a capital efficient way. But at the same time, options have been growing, you know, as kind of more and more sophisticated people enter and wish to express opinions on nonlinear risk. So like if they want to express direction at a certain strike price or at a certain maturity or play some kind of event. And as you know, we've had a lot of events in crypto. Options kind of allow people to structure like trades in that kind of way. They also have a lot of implicit leverage in them as well. So, and another benefit of them is that you get rid of the risk of liquidation. And I mean, and the biggest thing, like the biggest end users kind of in the overarching ecosystem of options traders are yield generating strategies. So like people who have large holdings of BTC or ETH or, you know, our miners or staking providers, they are the ones that kind of come in and say like, hey, you know, we have fixed costs. We generate all this BTC and ETH. We want to also, you know, figure out a way to extract yield from this so that we can pay for our fixed costs. So they have been predominantly the first mover and first entrant into this market. And then the rest of the market has kind of grown around them.
Mm. All right. So I think you just kind of outlined the three major instruments, right? There's futures, options, and then perpetuals. So maybe we could talk a little bit about sort of the history and like current state of the union of each one of those different instruments, like who are ultimately using each of those things, then what the market structure looks like that supports trading. And then maybe we can sort of back into at the end of the conversation something intuitive about you know, what any sort of metrics coming out of each one or the usage of each of those products tells us about just sort of like where we are in the cycle, which is like the perennial question that everyone's always
interested in. Yeah, everyone's always trying to time that. But yeah. So crypto obviously started off with spot, like, you know, people, spot exchanges were the first things to kind of come around in crypto. And it was just very simple to understand, you know, but as people started to trade crypto and, you know, wanted to, you know, secure borrow to short something or to run a neutral position, it became pretty obvious that you needed a future product. So one of the biggest, like, kind of first movers that took off in this space was BitMEX. I'm sure everyone, you know, everyone remembers those days when, you know,
run BitMEX the stops.
Run the stops, exactly. So BitMEX was one of the first movers in that. And obviously Binance, Deribit, Bybit, you know, FTX, all these other exchanges obviously came out and like leaned in and they just, you know, crushed it with perps. Like that was the product to use.
Nick, fun fact, like this is, I've got one fun fact about perpetuals. Everyone assumes because they got product market fit in crypto for the first time, but it actually, it wasn't like Arthur didn't invent perpetuals. So perpetual futures are actually, that was actually proposed by none other than Robert Shiller back in 1992. And I just find that such a fun, like path dependence sort of fact of history. It never really took off in TradFi, but just found product market fit with our specific type of degens.
Yeah, crypto, it's really fascinating. It's such a good, I think part of it is just that we had better technology like in current day to like support this like, you know, perpetual funding. You know, the way that banks and, you know, settlement operates on like traditional exchanges in the US where it's like T plus one settlement, I think was probably not too supportive of that. And then on top of that, they just banned any kind of swaps. So like this, yeah, that was like kind of a regulatory reason for why perps are still not allowed in the US.
Wait, can you, what is the connection between the settlement time there? And actually for listeners who might not be as familiar with like the actual structure of perps, can you just describe how those actually work under the hood?
Yeah. So perps have some kind of funding rate, which just depends on the difference between the index price and the market price of the perpetual future. So that funding price is usually paid out continuously or in some kind of time block. I mean, a lot of people look at it on like an 8-hour basis, so three times a day. Some exchanges have it continuous. And then, yeah, it just hits your account. And it's very easy to think about why, like, what the funding rate is. You know, people look at it annualized or people look at it on a daily basis. So it's like, okay, if I risk, you know, if I have $100 of position and I have to pay, you know, 1% funding, I know that my margin decreases by this amount. The other thing that's nice about perps is that they, you know, there's different kinds. There's some that, you know, have a margin in underlying collateral. So you can margin BTC to get long BTC, or you can margin USDT tethers to get long BTC and vice versa with shorts. So, I mean, that's the general product is very simple for someone to understand. It's just that you pay, there's either a long funding or a short funding. You either paying funding or collecting funding based on the balance of positions on, in this particular instrument. So, it's just like, it's pure delta direction. So you just have a exposure and price, whichever way it moves. There obviously you also run the risk of liquidations if your margin is depleted. So it allows greater capital efficiency. And one of the biggest like unlocks with perps, with, you know, these exchanges coming around and trying to win over retail users, is that they allowed huge amounts of leverage. I mean, Binance and, you know, all these other exchanges like kind of had leverage up to leverage profiles on small accounts, like up to 100x leverage. And, you know, I think we start to see some of that as well as like, as well in the on-chain world, as, you know, they start creating new perps, perp exchanges on chain, like that's how they're drawing in all these new retail users. And on top of that, I think also they're very quick with listings of new tokens. That was a pretty big reason why people love to use perps, because every time there's a new token, you know, you had these implied futures markets, a lot of users to speculate and get long or short.
And Nick, as part of the reason as well, I would guess that this is the demand driver on the exchange standpoint for why they do that, is there's probably an enormous amount of demand for VCs that have unlocks or something like that. Or like, you know, they bought some illiquid token. It's now been marked up like 100x. It's about to go live and they just want to lock their gains in. So they'll basically, they've still got the underlying, but then they'll just go short the perp to lock those gains in. Is that like a big reason why you think like driver of that market.
Yeah, for sure. And I think like, just on top of that, they can also hedge other instruments that are closely correlated that have might be more liquid and have better, you know, funding profiles. Because usually like when some kind of new hotly anticipated coin releases a token and there's like all this lockup that, you know, sometimes extends past a year, it's very difficult to carry a short perp position to lock in your gains for, you know, when the funding rate, when everyone, every single VC that invested into it, goes through and hedges it and pushes the funding rate to something that's unreasonable where you're not gonna, you know, not really gonna make a lot of money. And on top of that, it's also capital intensive. So you have to, you know, maintain margin. If this coin, if you're short a coin that you, you know, just released a token and you have some kind of locked token on the other side, and it starts to take off from a retail perspective, you have to keep posting more dollar margin, USDT collateral. So it can be, it could quickly turn into a capital inefficient trade, but overall, especially as like, as the unlocks get closer, we typically see some kind of action in perp funding as people kind of hedge their allocations. So yeah, it's definitely a useful tool for funds and venture. Yeah.
So one of the debates that you often see is, all right, perps have been this extremely dominant instrument that especially like retail will choose. But honestly, I feel like there's a decent amount of institutional adoption of perps, however you want to define institutional adoption. I think like amongst crypto native institutions, let's call it. And every now and again, people say, well, what about options? Options are the dominant instrument that more traditional institutional money managers like use to speculate in, you know, TradFi. And it just hasn't really seemed like that's taken off in crypto. There's obviously Deribit. There's Avo more recently that has on-chain options, but it just doesn't seem like that's taken off. And my sort of pet theory for that, it's a little bit of I just think the average probably retail user, in some ways they're more sophisticated than their TradFi counterparts, but in terms of like options or more traditional sort of market sophistication, they're maybe a little bit lower. It's like easier from a user perspective. And I don't know, like, what do you think about that? Like, why do you think perps just have so much better adoption than like options in crypto?
Yeah, that's the age old question that people have been trying to solve for quite some time. Yeah, and you're right. Like in TradFi, if you look at like, you know, just the general how much market cap or open interest there is in options on, say, like a stock. Like, I mean, Coinbase, for instance, is like one of the top 10 open interest stocks in terms of options on like US exchanges. And, you know, that's how much, and the options open interest, you know, obviously outweighs anything that's in the future space. So like, if you look at a product that has futures like E-minis, the options open interest is massive relative to the futures open interest. In crypto, we kind of have the opposite. Like, you know, we have huge futures open interest scattered across exchanges like Binance and CME now, which is the market, kind of like the market leader. But the options open interest is like, you know, not like a crazy multiplier of that. And that just shows like that the demand in the option space has not been as big as it like should be in a fully developed market. And I think it's primarily because the primary users of options are going to be people that are a little bit more sophisticated. And that has been like kind of the trajectory of every single developed market. It's like, you know, it's like pension funds, like long holders, banks, lenders. So it's like these people that, you know, own a lot of it on their balance sheet and have to manage it effectively and have to and do it through options and try to think about that holistically. Retail most recently has been like a very big growth factor in like zero DTE options and like short dated options for speculation. I mean, we saw that mania in 2021 with GME and other stocks. And most recently, we saw this pickup like in short dated options, zero DTEs. So retail still exists. And I think one of the reasons why like that kind of traditional finance retail, like in traditional markets, retail has not kind of spilled over into options on crypto is primarily because of like, there's, you know, not enough liquidity. And, you know, on traditional finance exchanges, you have insane liquidity on these options. And then here you just don't. There's only like what the main leader exchange is Deribit. And it's closed off to the majority of American retail. I mean, it's closed off to American retail. So you're not going to get that. And then on top of that, you also have, they have the ability to trade perps. So like people have ability to trade futures, and it's just like an easier product to understand. So for retail, it's a better product that they can understand the direction, they can understand the funding, and they can trade it in a much more cohesive way. Versus on options, it's a little bit more tricky to understand. So you have to deal with many different strikes, many different expiries. And I think that the current way that exchanges kind of build it makes it really difficult for a retail consumer to come in and say, hey, like, I want to trade some options. And then you have like a million strikes and you have a million expiries. And there's no like really clean interface that, you know, simplifies it for you and says like, hey, if you want to express like upside direction or downside direction on this particular crypto, like this is what you got to do. I think for the average retail participant, they just come in and they're overwhelmed with how many strikes and instruments there are. And I think that's something that will, like, as the UX and liquidity matures over time, it'll get solved. And then as there's more institutional interest and more deep markets and more flow that's going one side and like both two-sided flow, essentially, I think this is something that's going to kind of mature and coalesce into like a developed market. And this is something we have actually seen over the past like kind of, 9 months to a year. Yeah. Mm.
So one more question before we go a little bit deeper into options still on the perp side. What are the different venues that like where volume is sort of aggregated around? And then how do you see the relative development of like perps volume versus spot in general? Like I'm actually not sure what the relative volumes are. I know derivatives, you know, there's far more volumes on derivatives these days than spot in crypto, but like, what does that look like just perp versus spot? And how do you see that trend continuing?
Yeah, for sure. So the various exchanges, so there's obviously offshore exchanges like Deribit and a few others. And I would say you could count the on-chain exchanges like Avo as well. There's onshore, which is CME, which has been, you know, recently has flipped Binance in overall open interest in futures on Bitcoin. ETH not yet, but you know, over time, I think that'll also kind of happen. So that's the regulated way to trade options in the U.S. And then after that, there's OTC. So that's something that we Cumberland DRW kind of specialize in. We think that we see roughly like 50% OTC and like 50% like exchanges as like the total volume profile for us. So OTC is kind of special. It's more tailored for the customer. So it allows customers to margin in USDC, allows customers to margin in dollars. It allows customers to margin underlying token and really fits their profile of what they're actually seeking to do, what they're seeking to trade. If they're trying to just buy options, it's very simple. They just pay the premium and move on. If they're trying to sell options, they have to obviously margin with coins or with dollars. And I think the flexibility allows them to express it or allows the flexibility of margin is kind of the big winner for why people like to trade OTC. And on top of that, also just different expiries and different strikes, different instruments, like more exotic options that people don't have listed on exchanges as well. So those are the three venues. Each one of them have benefits and drawbacks. CME obviously is a highly regulated U.S. derivatives exchange, which is never has seen any sense of stress at all. You know, including like 2008 crisis, COVID, like no one ever thought that anything would happen on the CME. Like no one ever had any kind of trust issues with the CME. You know, people blow up all the time during these kind of crises and they get carted out and the CME stands and has this 100-year history of never blowing up. Derivatives exchanges that are offshore, I mean, everyone knows every cycle there's at least one that gets carted out. The last thing you want to do is have options positions, which are harder to unwind than a futures position on a failing exchange. So yeah.
Why is it harder to unwind an options position?
Well, if you think about it, like if you're structuring an options position with many different strikes over many different expiries versus like you have, you know, 10 coins that you just need to like hit buy and sell on to get out of them and clear out your margin, it can get a little bit more difficult there. So options positions also get tricky, you know, when vol markets go crazy, it might be harder to get liquidity versus like, you know, if you're never not going to have liquidity in BTC or ETH, for instance. So That, I mean, counterparty risk is kind of central to why offshore exchanges are perceived as a risk versus like CME. And then over the counter, same kind of thing, way more customizable. You know, you face counterparty risk on directly to the market maker that you're dealing with. Some market makers have, you know, especially if they're crypto native, we saw many crypto native market makers get carted out last cycle after, you know, all the loans and all the FTX and exchange things blew up. For someone like us, that is a traditional finance company that's been around since the 1990s and handled many different kind of tail events and crises. It's not as much of a risk because we also have like publicly traded debt and we have the risk management of like a sophisticated TradFi firm. So we face less counterparty risk on our end. But yeah, you kind of give that up with, you kind of give up, you have to kind of give up certain things to trade on one venue versus the other. Some venues will also have better pricing. Some venues will have worse pricing, but better margin. So it's kind of a trade-off in deciding which one to deal with. I would say that institutions and like high net worth individuals will generally opt for either like, you know, something where they can more like closely feel the counterparty risk and either, you know, face a regulated exchange or get like some clarity on financials versus, you know, more retail participant. Retail participants won't really care about counterparty risk. They're just trying to enter and exit a trade for like, you know, a day or two. So for them, it doesn't really matter as much.
Hey everyone, wanted to give a big shout out to today's title sponsor, Say. Now, I want to talk to you guys a little bit about why I think Say is cool from a design standpoint, a big problem that it solves for ETH devs out there, and then some cool stuff that Say has coming up. The reason I like Say from an architecture perspective is, again, it's a very fast blockchain, parallelization, all of that stuff, but Say has essentially been custom building block space, which is for consumer apps and DEXs. Now, they have some very cool features which enable that. So twin turbo consensus, optimistic parallelization, SayDB, all of this stuff allows you to reduce the time to finality, make for very, very fast transactions. So if you're building a consumer app or a DEX, this is basically the blockchain for you. If you've been building in the EVM, you love the EVM, but there are some restrictions about it that don't support your app. So maybe you can't do fast enough transactions or it's not parallelized, whatever it is, you can now take all that stuff that you built. You don't have to start from scratch and you can build it on Say. Now, recently they've launched V2, but also public DevNet. So the way that you can follow that and keep up to date is go and follow Say Network on Twitter. All right. Thanks, guys. Hey, everyone. This episode is brought to you by Uniswap, delivering the best on-chain trading experience, period, bar none. Now, if you know the history of Bell Curve, you know I did an entire season on DEXs with Dan Robinson of Paradigm. That one was a blast. We ended up talking about Uniswap quite a bit, so I'm a huge fan of the product and team. There are three really cool new features that I want to talk to you about today. One, limit orders. Two, real-time data and insights. And three, Uniswap X. So limit orders, you guys know what those are, but now you can buy and sell 700 tokens at your price on your terms. Also, we're going to get into this later, but it's powered by Uniswap X. You don't have to pay any gas fees. Two, real-time data and insights. Now, when you log on to this Uniswap interface, you can see real-time charts, transaction logs, pool data, and project information. Looks really neat. All that information is in one place, so you're basically good to go just from Uniswap. And then finally, there's Uniswap X. You get zero gas fees, no fees on failed transactions, and you get to source off-chain and on-chain liquidity. And if you want to nerd out about the construction, I think it's really cool. There's an RFQ-based system. They farm it out to different fillers so that you're getting the best execution price. So finally, if you want to go check out all this stuff, which I highly recommend that you do, click the link at the bottom of the show notes so they know that I sent you. Cheers, guys. Nick, let's talk a little bit about some of like who is using options today. So we were talking about this dynamic of maybe liquid funds that are benchmarked to Bitcoin or Ethereum, and then they use options to sort of juice their, maybe juice their returns is the wrong thing, but basically look like they're performing favorably relative to their benchmark. Can you describe that dynamic a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So I would say I talked a little bit about the yield generation. You know, obviously if you have large holdings of BTC and ETH and you write calls on it, or you also can write puts on it as the price is going up and as volatility is exploding. You get to collect premium on this and you get to sell some if it goes above the strike. That's kind of the yield generation framework. And on the other side, you have these like liquid funds that are, like you said, benchmarked to BTC and ETH. Their LPs are, you know, tapping on their back and saying like, where are the returns? But for some, you also need to show, you know, that you're going to be in line with, you know, this performance. So we see a lot of like liquid venture funds like come out and try to buy upside in options to capture this kind of move where, you know, BTC or ETH outperform. And then they know that, you know, they have all their other venture capital investments that will score if the cycle kind of continues. But it keeps like a smoother performance for them overall. And that's kind of a theme that we saw this year, especially like after, like as the ETFs were getting approved and after they got approval, is that people started to kind of just buy upside so that they didn't miss out like this further rally.
Out of curiosity, I know it's probably different at every fund, and actually some of these funds almost came at it more from a trading or a more hedge fund oriented standpoint, and then they started to do some venture investing. There were definitely some funds that came at it more from the venture standpoint and were like, hey, we should be either they got distributions of liquid tokens, or they started to say, hey, there's some upside to having a liquid part of our book as well. But these funds that are starting to trade options, like, do you think that's some of these investors necessarily have the competency to understand the options? Like, I would just think about like venture as a skill set, and, you know, buying or trading options is like a very different skill set. So I'm just like wondering how that kind of plays out in practice.
Yeah, I think for yield generation, and like I guess I kind of hate calling it yield generation. What you're doing is really selling vol risk premium or volatility risk premium. You're selling like the demand for volatility, which is usually like, you know, over time carries some kind of risk premium as to like how it actually realizes. So that's just kind of like a technicality that a lot of people like to highlight. But I think for people that are selling options for yield, it generally, I don't think you need like that much options expertise, because you know exactly what you're doing. You are, you know, saying that, oh, you know, BTC right now is 70K or whatever, 65K right now. I want to let go of some upside above 70K. Like, I would sell Bitcoin above there. I can collect, you know, for June, you know, actually say like 100K, like everyone's talking about the 100K strike. For June, I can collect like $2,700 right now to sell that call. I would sell Bitcoin at 100K in June anyways. Like, if it gets up there, I would sell it there now. Right now, I can sell that call for $2,700 and generate that P&L per BTC, or generate that yield per BTC. So it's very simple to think about. And I think that's kind of like the approach that a lot of funds kind of come into it with. And I don't think that requires a lot of expertise. Obviously, timing-wise, like, if you can time it better, if you can time, like, you know, pops and BTC to sell it like on a pop and sell it on a pop in a lot of volatility, that's better. So I think they, you know, some funds might have an edge in that. So they can enter and start trading it like that. Obviously, you know, for some funds also can't trade perps. It's, you know, they don't have a mandate where they cannot, like, especially after FTX, like, have, you know, capital on other exchanges that support perps. So how do they, you know, express leverage? They come in through options over OTC. So they will, you know, if they think that we might have, if they just saw like a flurry of on-chain activity or like a flurry of retail entering the market, they might come in and say like, oh, short dated, I want to buy some like upside calls. And effectively it gives you like similar leverage profiles to running a perp and just like running a trade on a perp. Obviously it's very defined risk. You buy a certain strike, you know that, you know, your terminal, you know, P&L based on where it settles. So that's kind of like the people that enter these kind of trades. These are the kind of funds. I don't think it takes that much competence to do that, to run more like relative value and like BTC versus Ethereum and like trade like different parts of the term structure where they're trading one expiry versus the other and like saying like, oh, I think like June is very expensive versus like December is very cheap because of the election or something like that. I think that takes a little bit more competency, but like for pure like price action oriented things and yield generation, I think it's a very approachable topic.
So on the subject of volatility, this is another one of those things where I feel like I understand it at a relatively high level. I think if you ask many other folks in the space, they would say they understand it, but it's unclear sometimes like what the implications of like high or low, either realized or, you know, just regular volatility is. So can you just give us an overview of like how you think about volatility in general? And then maybe we could start to back into some historic information. I know we were talking about before the show, like ETH volatility was at an extremely low level at one point this year? And like, how should folks who are listening in here, like, kind of generally think about volatility as maybe like a timing indicator in markets?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, volatility is just a measurement of it depends on the time frame that you measure it. So people like to measure it over the past month or like a past week. So it's just a measurement of like price action and how volatile price is. Just to give you a range, like, so people understand, it's referred to in an annualized way. So like, what's the annualized volatility of Ethereum right now? It's like, it's roughly like 60% annualized. What is the range for that? Well, it can go from like I talked about in the summer last year, especially when there was a large call overwriter in Ethereum, it got as low as like 30% annualized, and it can range up to like, it can explode up to like 150 to 200. So this is kind of the range that you're dealing with. And the way you do is, you know, you measure it over various different timescales, like over a week or over a month. And then you try to predict it based on like future events like the merge or, you know, EIP 4844 or, you know, the halvening or the ETF, like all these things will generally increase volatility because there's going to be more price action, whether up or down, you don't care. But as far as timing goes, timing volatility, like timing cycles of volatility, is pretty important because you generally start to see every single top of the market has usually had some kind of very high volatility event leading up to it. I don't think we're there yet because vol is creeping, like vol got so low over the last, you know, especially the summer, like over the summer, it got so obliterated and it's starting to climb up there. You know, we're in like the 80 vol range, which a few funds have always been talking about, like, oh yeah, this is like where things start to get kind of interesting, because, you know, we generally always see some kind of explosion of like north of like 100 vol. So that's kind of where we're at right now. Like the volatility has been steadily, like as these ETFs came on market, has been climbing and it's gotten into like 80, even though, you know, it kind of has its ebbs and flows, but generally that's where it's at and that's where it's priced. And I would say like December is kind of the target. December and June are the two like points of interest right now. It's like, how does everything play out with the election and how does everything play out with the Bitcoin halvening? So that's like where you see a lot of trading and people kind of speculating on like, okay, right now those two are like around 80 vol. Like if it really takes off, where does it go? So.
Right. Yeah. And there's a relationship, right, between the price of volatility and the profitability of selling options, right? And one thing that you and I were talking about a little bit as well before we got started here is this dynamic of miners selling call options as we approached previous all-time highs. And I don't know, I do think there was a little bit of market psychology, like we've talked about on this program, like I've talked about it many times. Like I thought the sort of mental model that I think was consensus in the market is once we break through all-time highs, you know, it's go time. And it hasn't really been like that this time. It's actually been sort of a break. And one thing that has maybe changed, you sort of hear anecdotally, is people, you know, usually retail is like, okay, what should I buy? But now you actually have bag holders from 2021 or 2022 saying, okay, is this the right time that I should finally sell these bags? And sure. I do think maybe that's something that's a little bit different. I mean, what's your read on that whole, the whole psychology around the all-time high?
Yeah. I think there's always like, you know, it's such like a psychological barrier to cross all-time highs. I remember we had the same kind of thing happen in, previous cycle with 20K. I think we broke off like 20K down to like 16K. And then like, we finally revisited it. And then like Elon, was it like Elon, I guess, like tweeting that would like really like sent us through it. But yeah, it's definitely like a psychological barrier. And, you know, you see, like, I would say like a lot of sophisticated investors like come in and just like, you know, every time we tap that area, they just start like unloading calls that they had before or, you know, taking some kind of profits, especially the last few times we visited. But at the same time, you have those people that are like, oh my God, I'm underexposed. I sold everything out. And there's like a famous like trade that one fund did, like where, you know, they sell out all their spot at all-time highs, but then they don't want to miss out on further upside. And then they just go out and buy calls. So we saw like some of that activity too. It's like where, you know, people are clearly selling spot at all-time highs and then they're just coming out, turning around and buying calls. Like, oh, if this thing like pops off to like, we're at 72K, like if this thing goes to like 80, 90K, we want to see some of that appreciation as well. So you kind of start to see like a little bit two-way in that space. I think this cycle, we're also seeing like a lot of these like DeFi coins that people kind of held on to and never sold. And that's always like been like a thing in crypto. It's like, oh, you forgot to sell like the all-time highs, like, you know, or you didn't sell it on the way down, or you added or whatever. Now it approaches back up. Like, what do you do? I think that's like actually like a benefit of options, is that it allows you to like, you know, when you're selling calls, it allows you to like force yourself to sell, and otherwise you generate some kind of P&L if it doesn't eclipse that area. But yeah, that's just, I think that it enforces like stricter like profit taking to your mindset. So.
What do you, what is your overall read, I guess, just backing into, all right, so we had like a sort of a similar situation play out in, if you go back to like November of 2020, where, yeah, it kissed like 19K, kind of went back down, meandered sideways to downish for about a month, had a couple of like attempts to break through. And I guess that feels actually very similar to today. I don't really remember what volatility was doing, or I do remember at that time listening to none other than Su Xu talking about, I think 3 Arrows Capital, one of the first, you know, big trades that they made very successfully actually was buying a bunch of cheap volatility at that time. So they were buying a bunch of those options, and then sellers got sort of steamrolled. I mean, do you see a similar risk today, right? If there's a bunch of folks who are selling options, that, you know, if prices really take off, they could, it's kind of like the picking up pennies in front of a steamroller type trade, or what's your sort of analysis there?
For sure. Yeah. I mean, we see a lot of funds that are continuing to kind of accumulate an upside, especially like, again, like the 100K area, like 90 to 100K area, especially as you approach the election. I think that's kind of like the trade that everyone likes to think about, like, where does BTC end the year? So obviously if they're buying, there's someone else selling, whether it's market makers or like, you know, on the other side, yield generating funds selling it. There's definitely that. I wouldn't say volatility is cheap anymore. Like, I think the real opportunity was to really get long it in the summer, where it was just like, I mean, but people at that point have kind of given up. Like, people thought the opportunity was to get long it like in March and April, and then like it's like people were just giving up. And I mean, there weren't any like long dated options trading at that time, so maybe it was like the right time was October, when you could actually get some exposure to the ETF stuff. But yeah, I do think that like there's people still continuing to accumulate options. If we do kind of break all-time highs again, and, you know, really send it to like 100K, we will, you know, the vol will definitely perform. It always performs whenever you break out all-time highs, and, you know, it could, you know, we've seen it go above 100. So I think that's definitely the thing, the angle that those funds are playing for.
So do you think that this market, like, now really moving into the editorializing, you know, part of this, like, does it feel a little bit like this market has barbelled? Like, you've seen, so obviously CME volumes and open interest has been, there's been a massive spike there, lots of institutional, like Bitcoin, ETH buying, et cetera. And then it sort of feels like meme coins are working. And then that's just about it. And my assumption would be the missing participant here is retail. And you really have like crypto doing these like PvP sort of games. They like, you know, they're the natives are the ones that have seen these cycles play out. They know it goes Bitcoin, ETH, you know, blue chip DeFi, all L1/altcoins, fin with Doge, you know, like that's where, and they're trying to skip to the end of the cycle and just buy the meme coins right out. And it feels like that's what's happening over in sort of meme, like, even if you just look at what's going on today, you know, everything is down, like Bitcoin's down, ETH is down anywhere from like 5 to 10%, whatever. But Catcoin is up 43%. This is not an endorsement of Catcoin. That was just the number one trending thing that I see on CoinGecko. Yeah. I probably shouldn't even name specific meme coins on this podcast, but you know what I mean? Like, does it feel like that's what's going on?
Yeah. And I think that's something that you touched on before. It's like a lot of people like coming in and like, you know, they were vesting their whatever blue chip DeFi over the last like 4 years. And, you know, this is like their final vest of them taking this part off. So, yeah, I mean, some of these protocols obviously have tremendous growth and tremendous TVL and, you know, tremendous use case, like, you know, the classic blue chip DeFi. But at the same time, I think you're also just getting like all these new coins that are entering the market at these like in like very high either market caps or FDVs. And I think they're just being priced more accordingly. I mean, look at like blue chip DeFi when it first came out, and then when it, you know, ripped a lot, was not blue chip DeFi. It was something new where people just started using it, and no one like really knew what the hell it was and how big and how useful it could be. It just like later now we refer to it as blue chip DeFi because people keep using it. People keep using Uniswap and Aave and, you know, Compound or, you know, all these other things. Now you have, you know, these like new narratives come out, whether it's like, you know, algorithmic stable coins or, you know, restaking is really hot right now. And, you know, these protocols are going to launch at like $1 billion FTVs, like multi-billionaire, like, or, you know, double digit billion FTVs. So, you know, that capital is coming, or that capital is coming from somewhere. And I think that's like what, you know, the next like blue chip DeFi of the next cycle is going to be. And I think it's just getting priced a little bit more accordingly as it comes out of the gates. And I think they're also, you know, this like slow issuance of, you know, points, the whole points meta is like kind of delaying like this, you know, liquid token being around and then it ripping, versus like, it just kind of launches to this FDV and people like come out and, you know, have points and they sell it to liquid funds that end up allocating to it like right on the launch because everyone's kind of aware of it. It's been around for so long and has generated so much user growth. I think it's kind of, that's the kind of the difference of this cycle. And then the meme coins are just in the background, kind of, you know, there's money sloshing around the system. That's the exhaust. That's how I always think about it. Like meme coins are just like the exhaust of how much money is sloshing around while people wait for whatever, you know, for whatever. And yeah, retail just loves it. It's, you know, explaining BTC and ETH is simple to retail. They'll buy it. They can now buy it in their brokerage accounts. Explaining liquid restaking, or like explaining, you know, how this like perp protocol is going to work, is, you know, and why they should buy that coin is a little bit more difficult to DeFi. Explaining it's cat coin season and buy the hottest cat coin, it's, you know, that's a lot easier. And I think that's why they end up buying them.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I'm like torn on this because I mean, I just haven't seen on the retail side of things. Like, I'm just so used to now when, you know, crypto's taking off, I get all these random calls, like people come out of the woodwork. I just haven't really seen that quite as much. And I don't know. I mean, obviously retail is buying Dogecoin back in 2021, but that took Elon Musk to tweet about it, right? It wasn't like everyone was doing that. We needed the most famous guy in the world, arguably, to tweet about Doge and SHIB and whatever. Yeah. I don't really think that retail, for the most part, is like finding out about the next, like now these things, I mean, you know, you had like Bohm or whatever that went up to $1 billion in 24 hours. Like that's not your grandpa's, like your mom and pop retail, no. Right? Like that's 100% insider crypto natives just aping in to that. I just think they're different crowds would be my.
Yeah. I think it's probably different crowds. Cause I think a lot of like people have, you know, set up their Coinbase accounts and they probably already bought Doge last cycle and they see it where it is now. Maybe they come in and buy some more, but yeah, maybe people are exploring. I mean, people are exploring Solana much more because it's much more palatable for retail to go in and like, you know, pay a few dollars for a swap rather than, you know, pay like $100 for a swap on mainnet. So, I mean, I think there's some people that are kind of wading into the on-chain world and there's some evidence of retail there. I would say a lot of it is also, you know, probably just like crypto natives that have been around and made a lot of money in the last like 6 months. And now they're just like, you know, playing these rotation games. So yeah, it's probably not the mom and pop retail just yet. I don't think those people have entered the on-chain world in mass. And I don't think there have been any like super hot exchange listings that outside of, I guess, you know, what WIF or I don't even know which exchanges that's listed on. I mean, that's been kind of like the big meme point of the cycle. It's on Binance, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I think. Or maybe it's Bonk that's on Binance, but yeah, WIF is the one that's done super well. I don't know. I just, you know, so we just did this conference, DAS London.
I was there.
Oh, nice. Great. Yeah. There was really interesting. So 1000X, one of the podcasts on our network, Avi and Jonah, we did a live recording and Avi asked this question, like, how many folks in the room like bought one of the Bitcoin ETFs? And literally in this room of like 400 people, two people raised their hand. And then it was like, well, how many people own crypto? And the entire room raised their hand. And I think that just like, what does that tell you? Like that tells you that there aren't that many new, like I don't own any of the Bitcoin ETFs because I have Bitcoin spot. And yeah. I'm probably, there's not much, like, I'm not the target audience for this, am I?
Yeah.
And so I just think it tells you that there just hasn't been much new, like,
been much eventually. New. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's possible. Yeah. I mean, I bought the Bitcoin ETF just to get the, I love how when you buy a new ETF, they deliver the prospectus, the fat stack of paper. So I have that sitting on my desk for the IBIT ETF. That's the fun part about it. But, yeah, I would say it's hard to gauge, like, you know, whether it's a lot of new retail entering versus, you know, this big institutional entry that has happened, especially in BTC. I mean, it's pretty evident that, you know, through the CME open interest, like, now you have a lot of hedge funds running the carry trade, which is, like, you know, buying spot ETFs, selling futures against it, and kind of providing capital into the ecosystem. So you just start to see, I think this is a much more institutional cycle that we have seen kind of take off. And the retail bid, it maybe it will come, but, you know, anecdotally, a lot of my friends that I've chatted with and, like, talked to, I think still feel a little bit stung by the last cycle where they haven't, like, come in with open arms into something just brand new. And I think that's, like, the retail bid in crypto is always caused by some kind of, like, new breakthrough in use, like, something that, like, you can, like, I mean, Uniswap was, like, a huge thing that, like, it took a while for people to realize what it was, and DeFi, that was what drew retail in. Right now, there's not, like, anything that breakingly new in the space that is going to draw them in to do the same thing. So,
Nick, I got a question for you. I was seeing on Twitter today, shout out to Larry Engineer, Larry Zero X on Twitter. Yeah, he's asking this question about Athena. So if Athena's strategy is delta neutral, why aren't hedge funds already doing it? So basically, I mean, this is something I sort of remember from last cycle as well, when people started talking about this carry trade or the basis trade, et cetera. They're like, why aren't people hopping in and closing the spread? If you could just basically get 20%, quote unquote, you know, risk-free, why aren't more people doing that? And I think that's basically what Larry's asking here with this question of, like, if there's, you know, 20 to 30%, you know, basically risk-free yields, or at least it's being portrayed that way a little bit. Not that Athena is necessarily doing that, but you know what I mean? Why aren't more people in the hedge fund community hopping in to close down that spread? Feels like a no-brainer.
Yeah, I mean, they are very much so in BTC and ETH, like on the futures and CME. Like, that's where they can get access to. They are hopping on and doing it. I mean, there still exists, like, so much. It just becomes a capital game. Like the basis trade overall is, like, how much capital do you have and how much can you put into it, and how much demand is there to push it the other way? So it's like, if you can evenly match the capital, like, if all in a perfect world, you know, your basis or, like, whatever your carry rate is going to be the risk-free rate. But, you know, it's like, if you look at, like, the gold market, for instance, like, it's pretty evident there, like, every single future is, like, perfectly lined up with the risk-free rate, because that's, you know, every single bank in the world can go out there and trade this thing, and they have, like, infinite capital to match all the buyers and sellers. In crypto, I mean, you know, now with the ETFs it's kind of been, like, the big unlock for hedge funds to that previously, like, couldn't even touch coin. Now they can just buy, you know, the any one of the ETFs and sell the CME listed future, and, you know, that will, you know, capture the basis. It's not perfect. I think it's, like, last I checked, it's, like, 12 or 10%. So it's not quite down to, like, 5.5, where, like, it could potentially go, but it's also, like, a capital game. Like, if they run out of, you know, if you are posting dollars on CME, you're going to, if it keeps going up, you have to post more and more dollars. So you have to have more capital and kind of work that into the basis trade. With, you know, the ideal basis trade, which is kind of what Athena captures, is where you post coin collateral. So, like, you don't have to add additional collateral. You can just post Ethereum to sell Ethereum futures. So those kind of collateral, that kind of collateral is, like, obviously, yeah, that is, those will actually trade even closer to in line to Fed funds. Yeah. And I think it's a capital thing, and there's just not enough people with enough capital, and there's too much demand for leverage on the other side, which is why it hasn't kind of compressed down to that level. But, like, if banks could participate in, you know, in coin margin futures, those things would be, like, it would be flat. Right now, it's just a few funds, and the funds thing to have. It's like, do you want to earn 20% yield on that, or do you want to go airdrop farm and earn like 70% yield or whatever? So yeah, it's like it's an opportunity cost.
So if it's just a supply and demand or like supply of capital problem, like what happens when more capital comes online, either directly from Athena itself or just from other like hedge funds that are looking to close down that spread? Like, yeah, I guess I'm sort of asking, like, are you bullish or bearish on Athena here? What does that mean ultimately for the future of that product?
Yeah, I mean, ideally, that's, you know, that's what they want. I mean, they'll have more TVL and it'll help them grow and, you know, be able to issue more and more stables. So, you know, I think that's the fact that they launched into an environment where there's a very high basis trade is probably like pretty good timing, because it draws more people to create TVL and like loop this thing and kind of grow the protocol in general. Yeah, I mean, Athena is an interesting idea. Obviously, there, you know, I'm sure you could go and find the FUD on Twitter about, you know, running such a very large, you know, trade, running such a very large basis trade. There's definitely risks with basis trades. You can look up how many times have basis trades blown up in very liquid securities like treasuries. It's a lot. Like there's a lot of funds, very sophisticated funds that blow up on the basis trade all the time. For funding, whatever.
How does that happen? In like treasuries, like how does that scenario happen that a big fund blows up?
Yeah, I mean, it's like some kind of demand goes, some kind of either supply or demand comes through that pushes the basis trade outside of you know, their risk limits, and then the people that run it are so levered because it seems so safe. So they just like borrow more and more and more capital and leverage it up so much just to like capture that yield. Then, you know, something happens, some kind of big shock, like COVID blew out the basis trade on a lot of people because, you know, the bid or the offer disappears. And then all of a sudden you're marked to market with an exchange and then you have spot on the other side. If you're marked to market with the exchange leg, so in this case on Athena, it's going to be short futures. If that, you know, goes through the floor or like goes against you, then you get, you know, you could potentially, you know, get into trouble there. Because then you have basically realized P&L on one side, and then you have unrealized P&L on your spot on the other side. So that's like, you know, that's a part that can always kind of impact you. And then on top of that, when people run very large, like trades like that, people generally know about it because it either shows up in an open interest or whatever. And then that, you know, that becomes like a target for people to like, oh, well, they'll have to get out of it X, Y, and Z here. And I mean, on top of that, like, you know, I guess you're always going to have with something that like runs most of its a trade on a offshore crypto exchange, like you're going to have counterparty risk as well. So, you know, people were freaking out about counterparty risk of USDC just a year ago. And it was being held in a US bank. You know, half of Athena is being held on, you know, offshore exchanges basically. So it's like, there's always counterparty risk there as well. So. Those are the risks of it. You know, you can weigh them however you want. I don't know. It's hard to like say like how it will play out in the future. But I mean, everyone's always talking about how we need like an algorithmic stablecoin. We'll see how it works out. Don't really have a straight opinion on which way it's going to go.
That's tough, man. It's I've seen today people. I mean, everyone always wants a decentralized, you know, algorithmic coin, and it's like it's just the. You know, this is the challenge that Maker ran into all those years ago when it decided to go down the RWA strategy. It's really just like, what is the demand to borrow here? So maybe at some point Athena runs into something similar. But, you know, Nick, this has been great, man. You've been super generous with your time. I guess like any closing words for the listeners, or if folks want to find out more about you, follow you on Twitter, whatever, you know, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, for sure. I guess closing thoughts is that I think this crypto options market is going to continue to grow. I think it will get to the point of like the stature of size of how developed crypto or options markets are in general. I think retail will be there. I think people will be trading zero DTE options just like they did on GameStop and all this other stuff in no time, as the UX liquidity and access kind of grows of it. And I would say that for institutions, it's a pretty great time to get involved because, you know, you're always going to make it in crypto if you're here, but you know, if you don't, you know, be careful and manage your risks, that's sometimes how people get wiped out. And I think options are just a great way to do that. And you know, doing it OTC or on exchanges with, you know, good market makers is generally the right way to do it.
Awesome. Well, yeah. Nick, thanks for coming on, dude. We'll have to do it again soon.
Yeah, thanks a lot.